On June 12, 2024, the Bozeman Public Library hosted a discussion by Betsy Gaines Quammen and David Quammen about their writings and their life experiences. The discussion was emceed by Scott McMillian.
Well, we're very excited about tonight. My name is Kit Stevenson. I'm the assistant director here at the library. And we welcome you all to the Bozeman Public Library. Thank you for joining us for our author series. We've been doing this for, I think, about 6 months. We've had John McClain, Heather White, Tim Sheehy, Chris Latray, and Teresa Nichols Schuster. And we're so appreciative of Betsy Gaines Quammen and David Quammen and Scott McMillian for agreeing to be here tonight. So I'm just going to introduce them and then we'll get going. Betsy Gaines Quammen is the author of True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. True West is the most recent winner of the Bozeman Magazine Award for Favorite Book Released by a Local Author.
Ray.
David Quammen's most recent book, Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus, was a finalist for the 2022 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Scott McMillian has won dozens of awards over his career as a journalist, and his book, Mark of the Grizzly, became an instant classic when it was published. Speaking of books, Country Bookshelf is also here selling books by the Quammens, right out there. Interested readers can visit with them in the hall after the program. And I just want to ask to please take a minute to silent your cell phones. And before we begin, I just want to have another round of applause for Lori, Rosalowski. That was beautiful. Thank you. All right. Thanks again. And let's begin.
Who begins? I begin? Okay. Well, thanks.
You're the boss. You're the moderator here, Scott.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I've known Betsy and David both for a long time. David longer than Betsy, but we're fortunate in this part of Montana to have so many great literary talents, and to see them join up together like this is truly remarkable.
I had no intention 22 years ago of marrying a literary talent. I thought I was marrying a conservationist.
We'll get into that later.
Okay.
I've moderated a lot of panel talks, but I've never had to be a marriage counselor. So this will be a new one for me, and we'll have some questions. Now, were you guys going to read selections first, or are you going to do that later, or how do you want to do that?
I'm easy.
Why don't you read a selection first? Do you want to do that?
Yeah. I want to, first of all, thank everybody for being here on the most gorgeous evening. It was so nice of you. We're very grateful. And Kit, thank you. Lori, thank you. Scott, thank you so much. Yeah. David and I are celebrating our 21st wedding anniversary next week, which is crazy. We've been married a little while.
Which is
really awesome.
So far, so good.
Yeah, so far, so good. I'll read a little bit. This is what the book is about. And oh, my friend Francine just came in here, who is also, she's in the book, and was just an incredible inspiration and resource in writing it. And a part of a chapter on acknowledgments, this book is about everything. It really tried to cover so many bases in terms of what the West is about, the mythology of the West, and what we have dealt with in the last few years in terms of polarization, pandemic, social justice issues, and in the West, new people streaming in for various reasons, and prices going haywire. And so I'm just gonna start with a little bit of a snippet of this book. On a rare cool evening, my pal Chris Ellingson, who is David's first wife, who I just adore, she remarked on a weird crossroads we stand before. She and her partner Pete have long have lived for years in what was once an old body house next to a longtime popular steak joint and dance hall known as Stacy's, a restaurant that at one time called to bronc riders on the rodeo circuit and maybe on occasion still might. It's filled with tourists coming to eat after a day spent bumper to bumper on giant rafts floating the Madison Gallatin rivers or cruising ski slopes at the exorbitantly priced Big Sky Resort nearby. Ellingson grew up along the plains and mountains of Montana and for a long time has seen folks come west with wild expectations, drawn by various booms from ore to oil that have pulled at those willing to work hard for good money before operations inevitably went bust. These incoming waves include not just the working class, but moneyed folk who have come to for hobby ranches and fortified retreats to dabble at cowboying and nibble at nature. Climbers, skiers, kayakers, anglers, mountain bikers, and various other adventurers arrive determined to rip, shred, bag, and slay in various and sundry way. It's as if the land is prey, butchered and consumed through recreation, extraction, and acquisition. The glories of this landscape, its resources, its stories, its assorted perceptions of it have made the West a mythic place, decorated with fictions and burdened with untenable expectations. The West has changed much in my years of coming here, and lately it's hard to keep up. The region has become hotter, drier, angrier, and more politically polarized. More people have moved here. COVID refugees flooded Western towns, some seeking medical freedoms, others wishing for some rumored palliative effects of desert and mountain air. Wealthy arrivistes, am I saying that right?
Arrivistes.
Thank you. Grabbed up their corn. I'm dyslexic, so it's hard for me to even read my own writing. Grabbed up their corners of mountain paradises, nestled next to federal lands, driving up prices and making it impossible for the working class and even professionals to buy homes. Christian nationalists bought up religious homeland, and real estate agents reaped the spoils of sudden steep influx of newcomers lured by dreams of separatism and hyper-freedoms. Politics, communities, and neighborly tenor have changed. In my town, trucks and cars roar by, emblazoned with Gadsden flags, the Don't Tread on Me emblem, like a middle finger raised to the community through which they pass. The flag's design is also available on popular Montana license plates. I wonder how many drivers realize that the coiled rattler they paid for, then screwed to the bumper of their Subaru, raises funds for an organization supporting the Federalist Society, a group actively working to take away women's rights. The West is a place of diverse stories, symbols, signals, and inescapable myths. It is a perception of profuse liberty, copious machismo, untraveled wilderness, rugged individualism, undiscovered free lands, cowboy heroics, blank slates, conquered spaces, reliable rain follows the plow, an enduring frontier.
Well, you kind of nailed it there in a few paragraphs. About what's going on. I mean, our history is boom and bust in Montana. Most of us know that. But I think this boom is different. You know, as people came and harvested ore and timber and furs and left. And they took the money and left. And now I think the resource that's being extracted now is us. And it's disappearing one backhoe scoop at a time. But you did a very, very good description of that. David, it's your turn.
I'm not exactly going to read something. And what I'm not going to read comes from this book, which is actually my most recent book. All due respect to Kit. Breathless is my second most recent book, which was published in 2022, autumn of 2022. And it's about the science of the COVID virus. It's Breathless, subtitled The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. It's about the origin and evolution of the COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2, and the scientists who study it. And for that, I couldn't leave Bozeman. I got through the year 2021 on one tank of gas here in Bozeman. And so I researched it by doing Zoom interviews with 95 of the world's leading virologists and public health experts around the world, from Tony Fauci to George Gao, the head of the China CDC, to graduate students in Edinburgh that nobody's ever heard of that were doing wonderful work on the family tree of that virus as it evolved. But that's not what I'm here to talk about, I guess, or at least not right this second. The Heartbeat of the Wild is a book that came out last fall, about the same time as Betsy's True West, and so we've been talking about these books together at a lot of book events. The Heartbeat of the Wild I describe as my narrative manifesto of conservation of biological diversity in the 21st century. What works, why it works, what doesn't work, why it doesn't work. And it's based on, but it's more than, a series of 21 feature stories that I did for National Geographic over a course of 20 years when I was one of their go-to guys for conservation of wild creatures in wild places. And they would send me to Mozambique or to the Congo or to Chile or to the Kamchatka Peninsula or to the Russian Far East to write about wild creatures in wild places. And rather than read you a bit of this, there's a part that I want to share with you, but where is it here? It's about 2 pages long, and I don't want to read that much. So I'm going to give you the spoken version. Scott, would you do me a favor and ask me if I've ever been charged by an elephant?
Have you ever been charged by an elephant?
Well, it's funny you should ask. only twice. And they're both in this book, and I'm going to tell you about the second one. I was on an assignment in northern Kenya with a great National Geographic photographer named Nick Nichols, who was my partner for a lot of the stories I did for National Geographic. And we were doing a story on one of Africa's greatest elephant biologists, a fellow originally a Scotsman from kind of an aristocratic family who, as a young man in the 50s, went to Africa to learn to fly an airplane and to study big wild animals, particularly elephants, Ian Douglas Hamilton. So Nick Nichols and I were spending weeks with him at his reserve where his camp was, his research camp, in northern Kenya, in a place called the Samburu Reserve, a wild part of northern Kenya. And Nick, at a certain point, had gone back home. He wasn't there. And I was there with Ian Douglas Hamilton and going out with him, usually, or with some of his young students, Kenyan, and some American students and younger researchers who were studying the behavior, the identities, the personality characteristics, the family structures in particular, matriarchal family structures of these elephants. And you do elephant study the way you do lion study, which is by sitting in a Land Rover and driving around and looking out the window and with your binoculars. You don't get out and walk around. You do not, you know, in America, they let us crazily walk through Yellowstone Park amid grizzly bears. But in the game parks, national parks of Africa, you do not walk around amid the wild animals, the leopards and the lions and the elephants and others. But this one day, after a long day when we were in camp and he was working on various different communications and papers and things, and I was reading scientific papers at my tent that I had there, at the end of the day, he said, David, do you want to go for a game drive? Meaning, do you want to get in the Land Rover and drive around still one more time and look at wild animals? And I said, no, Ian, could we go for a walk? A walk. Yeah, okay. We could walk up the mountain, the little mountain right behind camp here, which I think they called Leopard Mountain. And I said, that would be great. And so he got, this was a Samburu ethnic area. Samburu is a very proud East African tribe, sort of parallel to the Maasai, which is more famous, but they are equally proud and courageous and have a wonderful culture. And so he got a young Samburu warrior who was wearing just sort of a cloth and carrying a spear and spoke only Samburu, to go with us. He was security. So we go walking, and we walk up Leopard Peak, and at the time, it takes us a half an hour, and we're up there, and we're looking out across the arid plain, the sparse acacias of this sort of semi-desert savanna ecosystem, and across the big flat pan of these sparse acacias is another mountain. And I said, Ian, you know, it's still early. Could we walk over there? Well, yeah, we should. Okay. All right. So he's indulging me. So we go down, the three of us, and we start walking across. And we get about halfway across an opening, and we look up, and about 60 or 70 yards down this corridor between the trees is a female elephant with two calves. We stop. And we look at her, and she looks at us, and she throws out her ears and trumpets a loud elephant blast and charges for us, just comes running at us. And I'm thinking, okay, well, what's the drill now? What? Nobody told me what we do in this situation when the elephant charges. So we took off running, the three of us, just started running as fast as we could, running away from this elephant. And, you know, Ian at that point is probably 68. I'm about 65, maybe a little bit older, both of us. And we're running, and this Samburu warrior, he's just gone immediately. He's gone. You know, these crazy white men, I told them they should know better than this. He's gone. Ian and I are running. After about 20 or 30 yards, he stops and turns and throws out his hands and goes, ah, to the elephant, to bluff her to stop. And I've seen other people do that. And he has done it before in his 40 years of studying elephants. And it works. Sometimes. This time it didn't work. She kept coming, still charging at us. So now Ian turns around. Now he's running after me. Now I've got a 20 yards lead on him. I run up to a big acacia bush, you know, as tall as this room, and maybe 20 feet in diameter. And I run around the acacia bush and come off to the side into some tall grass and wait to see what's going to happen. And he comes running and runs around the acacia bush. And the elephant comes, and she runs around the acacia bush. And I swear, she goes around it so fast that she's banking her turn around this acacia bush. And then as I watch from, 50 feet away, she catches him with her trunk, and she picks him up and throws him through the air, this 68-year-old, eminent man, and he flies through the air, and I hear him utter one declarative word, help. And he lands in the tall grass. And as I watch, she steps forward and with her tusk goes jing down into the place where he is. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I've just got Ian Douglas Hamilton killed after all this time. And I've seen on a young man who was at part of their camp a scar like that. This young man had been disemboweled by an elephant, but Ian and his wife paid for numerous surgeries and he was sewn up. And I'm thinking, this is what's happened, and I've just gotten Ian Douglas Hamilton disemboweled. And the elephant backs off, and I come running up and try to help him sit up, and I'm patting him around the torso, and he's patting himself around the torso, and his glasses are gone, and his watch is gone, and his sandals are gone. And he sits up, and he's intact. And he's saying, David, watch out, she's still there. The elephant is still there, but she's starting to back off. And I get him on his feet. We get him on his feet and start to move away. And I look down into this sandy clay of the ground, and there are these two tusk holes driven into the ground about that deep, right where he was. And he's fine. And he said, let's go back to camp and have a cup of tea. So that's page 142 and 143.
I think I'd have wanted more than a cup of tea after that. I thought you were going to talk about you getting attacked by an elephant.
Not quite.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad.
Well, I was charged. I mean, I was one of the. She was the charger, and I was definitely one of the chargees.
So did she spear, like, on each side of him?
She seemed to go on each side of him. He said, oh, she meant to miss me. And I said, Ian, you're the elephant expert, but I don't think she meant to miss you. And then back in the camp, he calls his wife, Oria. His wife is a very strong character, and she's back at their house in Lake Navasha, you know, 100 miles away or more, and... he explains to her on the radio phone what has happened. And then I hear him saying, yes, dear. Yes. Yes, Oria. Yes, dear. Yes. Yes, of course. Yes, yes, dear. Yes, I will. Yes. Hangs up. And he looks at me and says, Oria says, tell David he can't write about this. Because we had disobeyed all the rules and made a fool of ourselves. And he was supposed to know better, although I wasn't. And I said, tell Oria to dream on. That did go into National Geographic.
What's the biggest thing you've been charged by?
Oh my gosh. When I first came to Bozeman, I brought with me the most wonderful dog that had been astray on the streets of Missoula, Montana. And he was probably a wolf hybrid Malamute. Huge, beautiful dog that I couldn't have loved more, but he was a rascal. And when I first met David, and this is funny, when I first met David, David did not like dogs. And I took Wiley.
You trained him.
Well, it was a deal breaker, you know, because basically I'm like, you love me, you love my dog. And so David decided that, okay, he was going to like dogs. And he ended up loving Wiley and wrote the most beautiful article when Wiley passed away for the Smithsonian magazine. It's absolutely exquisite about his walks with dogs and the fact that, you know, he hadn't been a fan. But Wiley was one of the most charming, I mean, he was huge, and he would walk up to baby strollers and stick his entire head, much to the horror of many mothers, but he would stick his entire head in and just kiss babies' faces. I mean, he had some really good politician moves. And he and I would go hiking. I loved to go backpacking with Wiley, and I would go, my dad would say, you know, I would disappear for a week or two at a time, just the two of us together with my backpack. And right before I moved to Montana, I was a backpacking guide, and so I loved to go out. Wiley would go off, and I wouldn't see him for sometimes an hour or two. Three times, he brought three huge moose, like, back to me. So he would go and he would start chasing a moose, and then all of a sudden the moose would say, oh no, you don't, and turn around, and then Wiley would be screaming, Mom! And he would come right. And so Wiley would come, and then I mean three different times I thought, we're both gonna die, and the moose would at the last minute just kind of pivot and run away. But yeah, I was charged by a moose three times.
Wiley would run in and hide behind your legs.
He would hide behind my legs. after he brought the moose. Yeah, because he was a big guy, but the moose would say, wait a minute, you're not a wolf. You are a chicken shit dog. And he was a mama's boy.
Did you scare the moose away?
The moose would just, when Wiley got behind me, and I think I was always kind of a deer in headlights, so the moose did not, I mean, it would, at the last minute, it would just kind of, each time it was kind of a bluff charge, but it was scary.
You're gnarly.
I mean, or stupid, or maybe a little both. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you both spend a lot of time in wild landscapes, but your work is focused on a different sort of landscape environment than David's has. You work mostly in the natural world, and your last two books have focused on things that seem to me quite unnatural.
Although she writes about the American public lands and the unnatural battles over American public
exactly.
lands.
Exactly, and those people. I know you had long interviews with Clive and Bundy on your first book, and you had interviews with Dr. Fauci in your next to last book.
Mm-hmm.
Could you put those two in the same room for me?
I doubt it.
Well, just imagine.
Maybe
I mean,
Jim Jordan's funeral. They might both want to show up.
I mean, what do you think they would say to each other? I mean, one hates the other. One hates the American government. The other one, as we hear on Fox TV, hates America.
Everything like that that's been said about Tony Fauci is pretty idiotic.
Yes.
He's an extraordinary scientist, an extraordinary public servant. And I could talk about him, but maybe you should talk about how you got your long interview with Clive and Bundy for your first book, American Zion.
Well, it's funny, Scott, because I actually think this was one of the motivating motivations for the book, because when I started, COVID happened in March of 2020. And when I started to think about the book, I was really curious about how the West was how people were maneuvering through pandemic polarization, misinformation, disinformation, and low information.
The second book, True West.
True West, after my first book was about the Bundys. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Bundys, they're a group of extremists from southern Nevada who have been involved in two different anti-government, one was an armed standoff and the other one was the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Nevada. But I really, this book was about Western mythology, but it was also about Western mythology in our moment. And so I called Ammon Bundy, Clive and Bundy's son, and I basically said, I've already seen what you're doing with COVID. I already see that you on social media are saying that, this is an excuse to take away our freedoms. And in the state of Idaho at that point, which is where he was living, Brad Little, who was the governor, had issued a shelter-in-place order. He'd asked restaurants to close. He was asking businesses to, or rather, religious gatherings not to be held. You know, basically not to provide opportunities for infection. And he was saying this is an affront to our liberties, and this is what the government does. They take an issue like this and they use it to take away all our rights. And I said, is this your next Malheur? Is this your next standoff? Is this going to be your next issue, the pandemic? And lo and behold, I mean, that's what he did. He spent the entire pandemic creating People's Rights Network, which was his own militia group, which was a community watch of people who didn't trust the government. And right here in Bozeman, Montana, the People's Rights Network protested every day in front of Matt Kelly's house, who was our
public health officers.
So those this coalition that Ammon created, they were in front of Matt Kelly's house with a bullhorn, intimidating neighbors and raising money while they were streaming it. And so COVID became a really big platform for Ammon to position himself. He ran for governor of Idaho. He got nearly 30% of the vote. And so he would have, Dr. Fauci would not have wanted to have anything to do with the Bundy family during COVID because the pandemic, in terms of Ammon and his role and his positioning, he really used it as an opportunity to amplify his message and to perpetuate his extremism.
But where our work does overlap, dovetail a fair bit with your two books and with this book of mine and with other books I've written, is that we are both very interested in the preservation of wild land and the wild creatures that live on wild landscape, preservation of civil society and civil discourse, and the preservation of the rights and cultures of the people who are indigenous to wild landscapes. I wrote a lot about that in my book about big predators and the people who live close to and pay the costs of big predators, indigenous people in the habitats of the Siberian tiger and the saltwater crocodile and the brown bears of Romania and the Asiatic lion in India. And you have written about this a lot too, especially in the second book. And we're very interested in the mechanisms, both the values and the limits of the mechanisms that are used to preserve wild landscape and wild creatures while being aware of human needs and human rights, especially of indigenous people. Mm-hmm. In this book, I've written about, for instance, a case in Mozambique, the restoration of Gorongosa National Park, a great national park in Mozambique that was destroyed during the civil war that began in 1975 after Mozambique was given or acquired, took its own independence from Portugal, of which it had been a colony. And for over the course of 18 years or so, the government, which was a left-wing government, and the rebels, which was a right-wing force, fought, and a lot of their fighting was done in this area that was a national park, Gorongosa. And they killed all the elephants for ivory to sell it to buy ammunition, and the government bombed the infrastructure. Anyway, I tell that whole story and how that national park has been wonderfully restored with the money and the help of an American billionaire who happens to be a great guy, despite being a billionaire, named Greg Carr from Idaho. And his team, his colleagues in Mozambique, and turned into a national park with a buffer zone around it, with the local people living still in their villages, with support coming to them in terms of healthcare, in terms of girls' clubs designed to keep young girls in school beyond the age of 12 so they don't get married off at an early age and they get to get educated and preserve their cultures and things. It's similar to, but it's outside of America, similar to a lot of the tricky decisions and battles that you write about in True West.
Well, and I was also going to say in American Zion, because this is what I talk about specifically, is the Bundys in American Zion and their land use war asserting that this is Mormon homeland, this is Mormon sacred space. I mean, running their cows on a public land, that they're somehow fulfilling this call to please the eye of God. That's the idea of Zion. That the idea of Mormon sacred land is Zion, its homeland. And there's no recognition that this is the sacred land of the Southern Paiute.
Yeah.
And that the idea that their history essentially begins with colonialism rather than recognizing the fact that the Southern Paiute have seen this land as sacred since time immemorial. And so that is a really big piece of this whole book. And I certainly address issues of it in this book as well. Yeah. So,
Do you see religious motivations for environmental destruction outside of America?
Definitely. I mean, you see both religious justifications for environmental destruction and religious bases of environmental preservation, depending on the situation, mm-hmm. depending on the place. In Madagascar, there are a lot of, you could call them religious, but they are traditional spiritual beliefs. They're not, you know, they're not the beliefs of a colonial church that came in and missionized them. They're the ancient beliefs of the Malagasy people. Things such as these lemurs are our ancestors. Our ancestors' souls live in these lemurs. We're not going to kill these lemurs. We're not going to eat these lemurs. Madagascar is the big island off the east coast of Africa, which is an extraordinary repository of biological diversity filled with reptiles and plants and mammals that are endemic species that exist nowhere else on the planet. Because it's been a large island like the size of California, separated by 120 million years from mainland Africa, and all over that period of time, some animals have gotten there that weren't there. For instance, early primates, prosimians, and from them evolved these 25 or 30 species of lemurs, these amazing kinds of prosimian, pro-primate. The only place really on the planet where you have lemurs is Madagascar. And you have these beliefs, religious beliefs, spiritual beliefs, that they should not kill them. Unfortunately, Madagascar is a very poor country with a pretty big population, and people are cutting down the forest to grow rice, burning the forest to fertilize these unfertile soils, and the lemurs are being killed not by poaching for their skins or to eat them or anything like that, the way, for instance, chimpanzees are killed in Central Africa, but they're dying for lack of habitat as the people eat up the forest.
Well, it's happening here and worldwide. I was just listening to Alan Savory on the radio last night, and he was talking about I believe he said 88% of the country's experiencing, or the world is experiencing, biodiversity loss. It's an astounding number.
Well, I would say 100% of the world is experiencing biological diversity loss.
He might have phrased it a little differently, a little more precisely than I did. But it's a huge problem, and Savory, I don't know, he's sort of a guru of regenerative grazing practices. Mm-hmm. It's been very effective in many places and slow to catch on in others.
Based on his knowledge from South Africa of
exactly,
wild ungulates on fairly arid land, right?
Yeah. And using animals to regenerate our land and halt or at least delayed desertification. But he talked about the loss of biodiversity being the root of desertification and global warming, and had a lot of interesting ideas. I'd never heard him talk before. It was interesting. But for the Bundy clan, I mean, that's not mainstream Mormonism.
No, I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah, but what I mean, do they have a sacred text, or is this something that they came up with on their own to justify the Empire of Zion? Which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think basically the whole Great Basin, isn't that what they see as the Empire of
well,
Zion?
Well, Zion was prophesied, according to Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. Zion was given to the Mormon people, and it was initially in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And so there were a number of issues in Missouri. First and foremost, many of the Mormons were abolitionists, and Missouri wanted to maintain their status as a place where people had enslaved people. And so there were a number of skirmishes between the Mormon people and the Missourians, and mob attacks and battles back and forth. And the Mormon people went to Illinois to establish Zion there, this idea of God-given land, kingdom on earth, sacred land. And that's when Joseph Smith created the largest army next to the U.S. Army. And so he wanted to protect his brethren. He was thrown in jail. He was assassinated. And so Zion went with Brigham Young to the Great Basin. And then Brigham Young wanted to create the Empire of Deseret, which was Mormon sacred homeland. And that spanned from Oregon all the way to Mexico. And so this was sacred land that God had promised. And it turned out that as the years went by and the Taylor Grazing Act was enacted and federal policies created, it went from the commons to creating federal land, that a lot of Zion was on public land. And so there's this notion, though, that there's an entitlement according to Cliven, and this is not embraced by the Mormon Church, although there have been a number of positions and policies coming out of Utah that really pushes for states' rights. And I, again, make the argument that some of this, I do believe, is this idea that they are entitled to, you know, God-given sacred land. And we've seen states' rights, not just in Utah, but Utah's been on the forefront, and Nevada's been very, very adamant about states' rights around public lands. But so Zion, as I write about, is something that is a holdover from early church theology, and there is quite a bit of early church theology that informs the Bundys and how they operate, their relationship to the Constitution, and their real belief that they are way more aware and well-versed in constitutional law than constitutional scholars.
Do I remember correctly that Cliven told you that the American Constitution was written by Jesus Christ?
He said, and I'm going to quote him, I think I have it about right, "The Constitution was divinely inspired, which basically means Jesus wrote the Constitution."
Okay.
Cool. Huh. That would have surprised Jefferson.
Yeah, I did. That was new to me.
And Madison.
And Madison especially.
Yeah, Madison especially.
Yeah. Yeah. You both studied so hard and thought deeply about the state of things. Are we doomed? I mean, is it just going to get worse? Is there reason to think that
you want to take that hot
life
first
in the world is going to get better?
You know, I it depends on the day. I think one of the things that's been inspiring to me, and I'm reading a book right now that hasn't come out yet, but it's by this wonderful Mohawk man who came from Canada. He now lives in Sun Valley, and he writes about Indigenous knowledge and this idea of we need to rethink everything, and we need to confront these systems, that are based on Judeo-Christianity, that are and based on the Enlightenment principles, that are based on capitalism with no end, and really go back to systems that during settler colonialism. We worked very hard to oppress and push down and eliminate, and it didn't happen. And there's this ongoing Native resistance that I feel like is really exciting, and I think that there's a lot we can learn at a time of crisis. I also felt like in writing True West, conversations and communities, community resiliency, relationships with each other, relationships with our neighbors, opportunities to be in dialogue. These were things that we weren't able to engage in during COVID, and we got right on our computers, and we heard versions of each other on our computers, and much of it was angry. And we decided, as local newspapers shrunk and blew away, that the only news that was important was national news, and we were all focused on national news, and we weren't going to soccer practices, and we were meeting other parents, and we weren't going to bridge clubs or book clubs. And that was poisonous. And I really believe, although it sounds so simple, that in engaging with one another and in being in relationship with one another and in finding things that are of common interest and are of common values, no matter who you're voting for nationally, that I really do believe there are opportunities to reengage and to move forward and to build solutions. And one of the things I heard the other day that I just keep thinking about is that we are right now in the United States collectively reactive, when we should be collectively creating solutions.
Should be. Are we? I mean, we had this conversation about 20 years ago.
We did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if my answer has changed since then. I doubt that it has. Some people say, it's so grim, I'm just going to despair, I want to despair. I don't think we have the right to despair. I don't think people say, are you hopeful? And I say, over and over again, I say that I am hopeful because I think hope is a duty. Hope is not a psychological condition or a mood. I view hope as a duty that we can't stop fighting. We have to keep fighting no matter how marginal our victories may be in terms of saving biological diversity on this planet, saving indigenous cultures on this planet, living in a balanced way, we humans with the rest of the planet, no matter how slim it may be that we can improve that substantially, we just have to keep fighting. And there are models, and I've described three different models in the Heartbeat of the Wild after I sort of define and explain and explore what I mean by the wild being big enough and wild enough to have a heartbeat in it still. That's another topic. But I mentioned Greg Carr in Gorongosa National Park, his restoration, not just his, but his and all of his Mozambican partners' restoration project there, which is working really well, having come from a place where it was just devastated by war, post-colonial war. The work that Chris and Doug Tompkins have done in South America, in Chile and Argentina, a very different model, buying up land themselves with personal fortune, buying up mostly derelict ranches, not buying up wild land or buying up land that indigenous people are living on, but buying up land that had been owned by, you know, Spanish ranchers for a couple of centuries and eventually was in very bad ecological disrepair, and Doug and Chris Tompkins started buying it and restoring it and then turning those parcels of huge parcels of land over to the Chilean and Argentine peoples as national parks. And then there's an organization called African Parks that works as a management body, contracting with governments in Africa to manage some of the most difficult national parks in Africa. A very different model, controversial in some circles, because they are very, very, very strong on ranger and warden protection and enforcement of conservation laws, protection of their animals. And if the other side has AK-47s, their rangers are going to have AK-47s, and they're very, very serious people, a very different model. But it's working very well in national parks, in countries where the national government is ineffectual at best, like the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Chad and a number of others. Wonderful countries with wonderful people, but problematic governments. African Parks is doing great things in a very different way. So there are models. And we just have to keep gradually lowering our human population level and our human consumption level and hanging tough and fighting hard and helping the younger generations to inherit hope as well as inheriting these problems and fight on. There's no alternative. There's no excuse for despair.
Is it easier, I mean, in terms of reducing our consumption, is that likely in America, Betsy?
Well, and I would just provide the caveat that, you know, it's people in America and in European countries that have the highest consumption levels. I mean, I think that it's that's really where, you know, an individual in the United States has a much different carbon footprint than an individual in, say, Ethiopia or India. And so I think that's important. I don't know, Scott. I think there are ways that we can do it. I think that there are ways communities can talk about it. I know that there are models for reducing consumption, and I know that companies have, you know, that there are certain models and ways and visions of doing it. But it has to be something that we make a priority, that we have big plans to do. I mean, it's not like I can have meatless Mondays and that's going to be you know, make all the difference in the world. But if there are huge cultural shifts, and I do believe those are possible, it may be that they're only possible when something absolutely awful happens. And I hate to even say that. But we really have no choice. We cannot continue to live the way we do in the way that we're operating now, because it's just not sustainable. It just isn't.
Well, one observation I've marveled at for a long time is that I think our consumption rate and our pollution rate is related to poverty, at least in terms of our food consumption, because our cheapest food is the stuff that's the worst for you, and it's also the most polluting, which is a conundrum that it faces the whole country. It puzzles me, but I don't know. Single mother with three kids, you know, I can go to the farmer's market and spend $30 on local vegetables, and it's my choice, and I enjoy it. For her $30, she could feed, you know, a lot of Kraft mac and cheese for her kids for a week. But anyway, we're moving along. I bet there's questions here. Some of the people have to have questions in the back.
What has been the response?
Could you speak up a little bit? I'm deaf.
What has been any, if any, response from the Bundy family of your work or your books?
Good question.
Well, I was able to talk to Ammon at the beginning of COVID after American Zion had come out. It wasn't very long. Actually, maybe it had only been a month. So I don't think he'd read it. I don't think they love me. but I do know that one of their very close friends, who has been involved, he was involved in what they call the Battle of Bunkerville, which was the armed standoff in 2014. I went to visit the family in 2015. And then Malheur, the wildlife refuge takeover, happened in 2016. This man, who's very close to the family, sent me a picture maybe 5 months ago of one of my books in Clive and Bundy's collection. He bought it for him. And so I do know he has it. And I'm on very good terms with this man, Vincent. He and I have had discussions. We come at these issues from very different points of view. But we've maintained a relationship over the years. And so, you know, I should say that the Bundys were quite cordial to me. They were very friendly. And it really wasn't until I left visiting them, I spent a few hours with them, that I realized that this was a very friendly family with very dangerous ideas. I mean, I knew that going in, but they were so kind.
Talk about the bodyguard.
So I went in and I had been sitting there and talking to them for about 3 hours, and all of a sudden this big guy comes in, and it was Cliven's bodyguard. His name is Brian Cavalier. They call him Buddha because he spent a little time, I think, he has a Buddha tattoo on his very ample Buddha-esque body.
Belly.
And so
lower torso.
Torso. And so he came in, and I said, Brian, you're just showing up now, because I knew who he was. I said, I've been here 3 hours. And he said, well, I wasn't too worried about a lady with a Prius and two giant dogs in the back. Because I had two fancy dogs in the back, because I had Russian wolfhounds, and they, you know, they were just sleeping in my little Prius. I mean, I was definitely out of place there. And apparently I wasn't much of a threat. So, when I left the Bundy's house, I mean, Cliven, you know, they walked out with me, and Ryan, one of his sons, is saying, have you read the Book of Mormon? And I have, in fact, read the Book of Mormon. So, yes, you know, and so Cliven gave me one of his copies and signed it, Cliven Bundy. So I have a Book of Mormon with Cliven Bundy's.
Did he give you a watermelon?
No, he's a famous melon farmer.
I know. Did you get a melon?
I didn't get a melon, man. But everybody loves his cantaloupes. And I mean, he's got a big sign in front of his house that says melons. Wow. So,
did you have a question?
Yeah.
So Thank you. I'm so excited. I've read two of David's books, and I can't wait to read your new one and your new, both yours. My comments are hopefully short. I wanted to just speak to this thing of hope and despair. I'm engaged in a Facebook conversation with someone who I don't think I've ever met in Bozeman, and we're disagreeing about the upcoming election. And I decided, I woke up this morning and said, I think I'm going to invite him for coffee. And so that's my micro action. But an action that I think is really worth anyone who's interested in saving our planet and our country. I've been involved for 4 years now with Focus for Democracy, the number four. And their strategy started with two parents at a kitchen table, and now every few weeks they have 1,800, well, last week they had 1,800 people on their Zoom call. And what their strategy is turning hope into action. And what they do, instead of recommending candidates, they meticulously research organizations that are doing the most effective work to reach the citizens of our country, whether they are white suburban moms, people of color, Working America is an organization, youth. And what they do is research the organizations that are underfunded and under the radar, hold these Zoom calls every few weeks, let the executive director of these organizations speak on the methods that these organizations use to reach our citizens, to empower them so they can understand how that the policies that they are voting on, represented by the candidates who we have, how those policies will impact those various demographics. So instead of, I know I'm getting, so bottom line is, if you want to know more, it's focus4democracy.org, or you could just find me after this. And it's giving me solace in that whatever happens at whatever election we're facing, I will feel like I didn't waste my time and didn't waste my money, because they're using data and they're covering all the things that we all know our planet needs and our country needs if we have a prayer of survival. So thanks for that.
Okay. Thank you, Lori.
Mm-hmm. Over here.
So I won't go on, but I just graduated with a degree in microbiology and a minor in English, and I care a lot about science communication. And one of the things that I really appreciate about your books, David, is they're really useful and interesting and applicable to people who know stuff about the field already. And I've also given the tangled tree to like half my friends and family when they're like, so explain what you're interested in. So my question for both of you is, when you are communicating about these often very tricky topics, how do you envision your ideal audience? And then how do you balance like communicating the facts versus engagement, particularly with an audience that might be hostile to you?
I certainly have an answer to that.
Go ahead.
So I write about some very technical things, aspects of science, as you say, in The Tangled Tree. It's a book about the tree of life as it's been discerned with molecular genome sequencing evidence, and it turns out to be not a tree, but something that has branches flowing into other branches, genes moving sideways across species boundaries, carried by viruses in some cases, not just genes moving from parents to offspring. When I pitched that book to my publisher, I said, well, I've got a couple of different ideas. One is this redrawing the tree of life. And they said, oh, we want the one about redrawing the tree of life. Little did they know that I was going to write a history of molecular phylogenetics. And then we were going to try and sell it to the general public. But whether I'm writing about something technical like that or about viruses, which I have written about a lot and and I guess I'll put in a little plug. I've got it. If you're curious about what's going on with cow flu, influenza, avian influenza, getting into cows and whether that is a threat to people, I have an op-ed in today's New York Times on that subject. Mm-hmm.
That's about what you're talking about, affordability.
So I think of science writing about these technical things as it has to be more than explaining. It has to be, you have to offer readers not just explanation, but you have to offer them elegance and humor and surprise and music, as well as explanation, and human character, human story. And all of those things are always on my mind, whether I'm writing about molecular phylogenetics or emerging viruses or island biogeography or whatever. Thank you for the question. You want to answer that one, or you want to go to a different question? It's about time to wind up. I don't know, Kit, should we take one more question?
Just take one more question.
One more question?
From our very own Beth. Well, I was just going to say what you were talking about in your science writing, Betsy, you do so well. You both are doing that kind of writing where you're explaining these incredibly complex issues and giving them context and talking about the history, and I never feel so smart as when I read your books.
I love hearing that.
Thank you, Beth. And thank you for all the work you did to make this possible tonight.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all. Thank you so much. And thanks to the library. God bless the Bozeman Public Library.
Yay.
Oh, and God bless the Country Bookshop.
And the Country Bookshop. Because
if anybody wants
Book think is out there.
Signed, we will be happy to do that.
Can I say one thing about the genesis of the library? Yeah. Some of you may know that this was a Superfund site at one point. I helped create that. When I was 20 years old, there was a recycling company on this property, and I had a job that I stuck out for 2 weeks chopping up car batteries with an axe on the ground.
Right here,
where we stand today. So that was on me, but I did make $3.50 an hour doing it. Thanks, everybody.
And thanks to Scott.
Everybody.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, this was really fun.
That was a discussion by Betsy Gaines Quammen and David Quammen, emceed by Scott McMillian at the Bozeman Public Library on June 12th, 2024.